From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Amy Rigby on how she went from Catholic schoolgirl to punk rock fan to acclaimed singer-songwriter and mother. Her breakthrough was her 1996 album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, for which she wrote a kind of manifesto about why she needed to write songs and what she wanted to write about.
I didn't want to fight about sex and laundry with my husband unless I could turn it into a song.
People relate to her lyrics.
At night we pass out before 10. Are we ever gonna have sex again?
Amy Rigby's written a new memoir. Later, film critic Justin Chang reviews the new drama, The Assistant, inspired by the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. It's about a young woman who becomes an assistant to a movie mogul. First News. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After years of being a devoted music fan and a regular at New York punk clubs in the late 70s, my guest Amy Rigby found her calling, writing songs and singing them herself. She's great at writing prose, too. Her memoir, Girl to City, was described by our rock critic Ken Tucker as the best rock memoir he read in all of 2019. It explains how a Catholic schoolgirl from Pittsburgh became part of New York's punk scene and invented and reinvented herself as a performer and songwriter. It took a while before Rigby had the courage and confidence to stand on stage alone. She first performed in a band with her younger brother Michael called Last Roundup, which combined a punk and country sensibility and was described by some critics as cowpunk. From there, she sang with the all-women trio The Shams. By the time she made her first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, she was 37. But it wasn't too late to be noticed. In 1996, that album was voted number 8 in the Village Voice's annual Music Critics poll. The housewife part of the album title refers to how she was already married and a mother when she made the album. And, as she said, she decided she wasn't going to scrub the bathroom floor unless she could write a song about it. Let's start with a song that's a tribute to songs she loves. It's called Dancing with Joey Ramone.
He walked into the party looking just like he had in the past. He came up to me. Tried to say something, he said, girl, shut your mouth. They're praying Papa was a Rolling Stone. Last night, I was dancing with Joey Ramone. He was cool in his leather jacket and his little dark shades. He started dancing around, I tried to copy every move. Brushed me off, and they played Hanging on the Telephone. Last night, when I was dancing with Joey Ramone, they played the worst that could happen by the Brooklyn Bridge. He hit me, and it felt like a kiss. Quite all over, needles and pens. Be my baby, again and again. Gloria, by the shadow.
Amy Rigby, welcome back to Fresh Air and congratulations on your memoir. I love that song, Dancing with Joey Ramone. You pay tribute to so many lyrics in that song. It's so much fun and it's got such great energy. You came to New York from Pittsburgh where you grew up. You came to New York to go to Parsons School of Design and you planned on being a visual artist. But this was the era, it was the era of punk. It was the era of CBGBs. Describe what the punk scene was like then in New York and what the clubs were like.
There basically felt like there was two clubs, CBGBs and Max's, and downtown seemed to be where I felt comfortable, and that's where CBGBs was. And, you know, it was grungy, it was dirty, it was dark, everyone was smoking, it smelled of beer, and it felt like it was always either really, really hot or really, really cold in New York back then.
One of the first friends that you made in New York who was very important to you and also became a boyfriend was named Bob, or at least you call him Bob in the book and in a song. and you write that he seemed exotic to you when you met him. I mean, you went to Catholic school. He was Jewish. He chain-smoked. He took Valium and loved Lou Reed even when he didn't. What was the importance to you of having somebody who was from New York? He was from Long Island. He already knew the clubs when you got there, and he was like a mentor and a friend to you.
He was. I think a big thing about it that it was hard for me to understand, how did he know what was great and what was kind of crappy? How could he tell? Like, he'd say, don't go to that deli, go to this one. Or, you know, their coffee's bad, go to this place. Don't read the Daily News. Read the New York Post. He just, and that seemed like such a New York thing to me, that ability to make these judgments, and they seemed kind of arbitrary, but were made with such conviction. And so he was like that with music too. So I wanted to be able to form an opinion and be critical and also be super enthusiastic about things too. So, you know, I did kind of become a little bit of a pupil of his.
So Bob was your friend, he became your boyfriend, and then reverted to being a friend again. You wrote a song for him that I want to play called Bob, and you wrote this, I think, years after you split up. And in the song, you thank him, and you talk about how the last time you saw him, you were performing, and he seemed so happy for you. Tell us more about what inspired this song, what he was doing, what you were doing.
Well, he had moved out west to Seattle, and to me, Bob was New York. I never expected that he'd leave the tri-state area and go somewhere else. And so I was playing at the Bumper Shoot Festival in Seattle, and it was really my first big festival after my first solo album came out. And so it was a big deal for me. And then he came to the show, and he just was standing on the side of the stage when I got up there and played. And I think I did a pretty good job. I rocked at some point in this set, and I looked over and just kind of saw him, and he was right there with me. And I just, it felt like such a sweet moment. And actually, that was a beautiful thing about writing about my life. It somehow made the song deeper. When I play the song, it has even more meaning. Somehow, like, I got to, like, fall in love with that time and with him and what he taught me all over again.
So let's hear Amy Rigby performing her song Bop, and this is from her 2018 album, The Old Guys.
The last time I saw Bob, he was standing at the side of the stage with a big smile on his face, and he gave me a wave. He had a Marlboro in his hand and a crazy look in his eye, and he seemed so excited for me that I wanted to cry. How can I tell how it was? Show you
was Amy Rigby from her 2018 album, The Old Guys, her song, Bob. So are you and Bob still in touch?
Occasionally. I talked to him after I put out the record in 2018, and I sent him the record, and I wanted to know what he thought of the song, and we talked on the phone, and we launched into talking about music and kind of random things, just like we always had. And at the end of the conversation, I said, so what did you think of the song? And he said, well, that's for another time. We'll talk about it later. And that was kind of,
oh,
that was it. So I'm still waiting to hear.
Oh, okay. So we've been talking about how your boyfriends early on when you moved to New York and you were into the punk scene were kind of like openings into the world, deeper into the world of music and bands and art. And then you went to England to study art. And you were in England, you wanted to be on your own. You weren't looking for a boyfriend. And you were kind of valuing the independence and getting a sense of who you were. Then you returned to New York and started playing music. How did you learn to play?
I learned in public, pretty much. It was a really interesting time in New York City. There were all these little galleries and spaces where people were putting on variety shows. And my band, Last Roundup, we got together. There were four girls, two guys. One of them was my brother. And we just started playing our version of country music with one guitar, a fiddle that had maybe two strings, a lot of harmonies, or what we thought were harmonies. It was very it was very kind of crude and primitive, but it had a charm to it. So anyway, I started writing songs for that band, and we just kind of kept working and getting better bit by bit.
So let's hear a little bit of a song from that period. And this is like your really early days as a songwriter and your very early days as a singer. So should we hear At the Well? And this is, you described this as the first time you were comfortable singing harmony with the person who was the lead singer of the band.
Yeah, Last Roundup sort of splintered a bit, and we ended up with just my brother and bass player Garth Powell, and then a wonderful singer named Angel Dean, who was genuinely from the South. She was from Tennessee, and she had a really powerful, great voice, and I learned a lot from her. At the Well is a song that I wrote that felt sort of like a breakthrough for me, just as far as the imagery and the general feel of the lyrics felt like I wasn't copying someone else. It was coming from inside. And so this was the first one that I felt like I could sing along with Angel. We sang in harmony.
So let's hear At the Well from an album from Amy Rigby's very early days when she was with the band Last Roundup. And this is from their album, Twister.
Lately I've been spending most all of my days at the well, staring into the deep, deep water like I'm under some kind of spell. Can't see my reflection 'cause the light down there.
Song written by Amy Rigby. You heard her singing harmony on it, and that's from the album Twister when she was with the band Last Roundup. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Rigby, songwriter, singer, and now author of a new memoir called Girl to City. I'm going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Amy Rigby. She's a songwriter, singer, and now the author of a new memoir called Girl to City. You write in your book that there were feelings you couldn't really articulate in real life, but they came out really easily in songs. And once you started writing songs, you realized, wow, you actually did have something that you loved and that you were good at. Did it give you more confidence as a performer? Because you were singing your songs. You had a reason to be there, something you knew you did well.
That took a little while. After last roundup, I had the Shams, a band called the Shams, and we were three women singing in harmony. And again, I think I felt most comfortable singing with other voices. I loved arranging harmonies, and I just didn't feel comfortable with the focus all on me. So it just seemed more possible to get up on stage that way.
So you got married to a musician, Will Rigby, who was the drummer in the DBs. And I think soon after you got married, you got pregnant. And you were on the road. You were touring while you were pregnant. Where were you musically at the time?
Last Roundup had put out an album on Rounder. It had taken years to get to that point. But like many bands, that first record took so long, by the time it came out, we were sort of on the verge of splitting up. And so that was the point where I thought, maybe I should have a baby. And just strangely enough, like just thinking about it seemed to make it happen. It came true. The next thing I knew, I was pregnant. And I think I thought getting pregnant and having a child would mean that I would like put all this foolishness away, and that I would find something real to do with my life, and that music was kind of like gonna, just be this childish thing that I stopped doing. But it didn't work out that way.
No, which is good. I mean, I'm glad you remained in music. So you were on the road performing while you were pregnant, and then after your daughter was born, at some point you went back on the road occasionally. And, you write that when your husband was on the road, it meant like, well, he was out like earning money. But when you were out on the road, you felt like really bad about it.
Well, at first I just took her with me. And that was pretty wacky because, I was with the Shams and there were three of us girls. And then we'd bring a friend along to kind of keep an eye on my daughter while we were actually on stage. But we were in an unair-conditioned van. We had baby food jars floating in a beer cooler of, just like melted ice. And just trying to get my daughter to go to sleep at night after a gig was really hard. She would be just so easy while it was all going on, but then she'd kind of react when all the excitement died down and we were all trying to go to sleep. But as things went on and, she started going to preschool and stuff, it was hard. I couldn't really take her with me. I mean, I loved to go out and play, but I felt like I would miss stuff at home and that she needed me. And I just was trying to balance it as best I could.
After, I don't know how long, after a few years, your marriage was ending. And you wrote a song I really like about a relationship that is kind of looking like it's going to end, a relationship that's deteriorating, and nobody wants to be around you because they can all see the conflict and the trouble.
and the song, crazy.
Yeah, the song is called "When a Piece of the Sky Falls," and I'd like you to talk about writing this song.
It's a song that I completely forgot about until a few months ago. I was putting together a disc of demos that I recorded over the 80s and 90s when I was just learning to write songs and then eventually writing songs that would eventually turn into Diary of a Mod Housewife. But I completely forgot this song, and so I don't even really remember writing it. I just know that at the time I was thinking, well, if I can't have an artist's career, maybe I could write songs for other artists in Nashville to record. And I kind of feel pretty sure that this was one of those that I thought maybe I could find somebody. I was starting to send cassettes of songs down to publishers in Nashville and hoping, well, maybe Reba McEntire or the Judds, you know, maybe this could work for somebody like that. So that's what this song was about. But hearing it all these years later, I thought, wow, it feels so real and raw. And my own experience, I can kind of imagine that somebody probably wouldn't have wanted to record it.
Well, the song has an interesting angle because it's in part about people not wanting to be around this couple because the relationship has become so toxic.
Yes, I think it almost makes you feel a little bit like, ooh, uncomfortable.
Yes, which is what makes it so good. So let's hear When a Piece of the Sky Falls. And this is from the companion CD that Amy Rigby has released, is a companion to her memoir, Girl to City.
The tongues are wagging, our hearts are dragging. Everybody knows we're all washed up. We've been so distant, so inconsistent. We made a mess of this love. People who see us all wanna flee us. They don't wanna get too close. Dissatisfaction, it could be catching. Nobody wants a dose. When a piece of the sky falls, everybody run for cover.
We'll hear more of my interview with Amy Rigby and hear more of her music after a break. And Justin Chang will review the new film drama The Assistant about a young woman working for a movie mogul. It's inspired by the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Capital One, committed to reimagining banking, offering savings and checking accounts that can be opened from anywhere. Capital One, what's in your wallet? Capital One NA. And from the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and in developing countries, and working to inspire and enable the next generation of inventors. More information is available at lemelson.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to my interview with singer and songwriter Amy Rigby. Her new memoir, Girl to City, is about how she went from Catholic schoolgirl to devoted music fan in New York punk clubs in the 70s, and then found her real place in the music world, writing songs and singing them herself. Her breakthrough was her 1996 album, Diary of a Mod Housewife. When we left off, we heard her song, When a Piece of the Sky Falls, which she wrote when she knew her first marriage was in trouble. So I love that song because it's about a deteriorating relationship. But you wrote another song called We're Stronger Than That. That's about a relationship that's kind of teetering. But, you know, the singer has faith that this relationship can stay together because, baby, we're stronger than that. It's such a nice contrast. How far apart did you write these two songs?
Probably within a year or even half a year of each other. And I think, you know how I was just saying, when a piece of the sky falls, I felt sure it wasn't going to work for another artist because it had that discomfort. I think I purposely wrote "We're Stronger Than That" because I thought I should be more positive. And maybe if the song says that the people stay together, maybe it will work for me too. I think it, not just as a songwriter, but maybe you could pep talk yourself into keeping things together.
Did it work?
It didn't work. It didn't feel false. It felt, you know, because like you've said and we've talked about, I grew up Catholic, and it really felt like marriage meant forever.
So why don't we hear "We're Stronger Than That," and this is from your solo album, your first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife. That's Mod, M-O-D.
When we made our vows to have and hold, we never thought about how love grows old. Well, even healthy trees run out of sap. Baby, we're stronger than that. And when I look at you, I see too much. I try to walk away when things get rough, but every time I do, I come right back. 'Cause baby, we're stronger than that. We're stronger than the fairy tales, diaper pails, lack of heat, urge to cheat, shattered hopes, tired jokes, doctor bills, urge to kill. When we have another argument, you wonder where your feelings for me went. Well, even sugar peas run out of snap. Baby, we're stronger than that.
That was Amy Rigby, a song she wrote and recorded on her first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, in 1996. So when your first solo album, Diary of a Mod Housewife, was released in 1996, you wrote a manifesto, a kind of manifesto to accompany it, and you reprinted in your new memoir. I'd like you to read it for us.
In the memoir, I left out the second half of it, but this is the gist of it. I've been a mod housewife since 1993, when I decided I was not going to get down on my hands and knees and scrub the bathroom floor unless I could get up on stage and sing about it. I didn't want to fight about sex and laundry with my husband unless I could turn it into a song. Somehow, going to work at a crappy job made more sense if I could look at it as research. Oh, I'd played music for years, but that was with friends, for fun. This is different. This is about sanity.
What do you mean by this is about sanity?
I think by the time I was making Diary of a Mod Housewife, I was kind of just singing for my life. I just was so mixed up and wanted to do right by my daughter. I didn't want to end my marriage, but I just didn't know any way out that didn't involve like splitting up. So I guess I was in a way working it out through writing.
Did you feel like you were not only writing songs about, but trying to say that you can write songs about the kind of things that rock songs didn't exactly celebrate in the past, like songs about housework or songs with a diaper pail in the lyrics, or even songs about, like, not having sex?
Yeah, I mean, it was, even as a child or a young person, it was a revelation to me to read Irma Bombeck and to see that someone could be in a magazine talking about cleaning the kitchen sink. That really struck me and stayed with me. And again, in the 80s, Joyce Maynard had her column, Domestic Affairs, and Mary Cantwell wrote in Vogue about cooking her kitchen. And I thought, it's in like this national magazine, but you're allowed to talk about these humble, homey things that, you know, maybe in the past I would have thought, well, it doesn't have that much value as things like that men go out and do. So I really consciously wanted to talk about that stuff in songs, and in the same way that I read it in those writers' stuff. I thought it would resonate with somebody, and that somebody needed to do it and say that it was okay.
I want to play a song that you wrote called "Are We Ever Going to Have Sex Again?" this comes later. You recorded this in 2003, but it's a really funny song that I think a lot of people will probably relate to, and it's an example of something that could be very uncomfortable in real life. It makes for a very funny song. Tell us about writing it.
Well, the idea came from a friend in Nashville, Sherry Rich, and she, at that point, was married with a young child, younger than my daughter was at the time. And so she had the idea, the line, "Are we ever going to have sex again?" And, you know, she kind of handed it off to me. I got some lines flowing, and we wrote this song. And it always seems to strike a nerve with people.
So this is Amy Rigby from her 2003 album, Till the Wheels Fall Off. And the song is, "Are We Ever Gonna Have Sex Again?"
Life's become a great big list of things to do and buy and fix. At night we pass out before 10. Are we ever gonna have sex again? I looked for your it today. Seemed that it had gone away. Ain't been used since who knows when. Are we ever gonna have sex again? We used to be triple X rated. Look at us now. So domesticated. Don't you hate it? To babe and stud, too much KFC and bud. I'll shout it out into the wind. Are we ever gonna have sex again?
That's Amy Rigby from her 2003 album, Till the Wheels Fall Off. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is songwriter, singer, Amy Rigby, who now has a new memoir called Girl to City. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the NPR Wine Club, where every bottle tells a story and NPR shows become wines like Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon, available to adults 21 years or older. Learn more at nprwineclub.org. And from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is songwriter and singer Amy Rigby, who's the author of a new memoir called Girl to City. So I want to talk with you a little bit about your life now. So you're married now to Eric Goulden, a.k.a. Reckless Eric, who is probably best known, especially in the U.S., for his hit Whole Wide World. Why don't we pause here and listen to it?
When I was a young boy, my mama said to me, "There's only one girl in the world for you, and she probably lives in Tahiti. I go the whole wide world just to find her. Or maybe Maybe she's in the Bahamas, where the Caribbean sea is blue. We've been in a tropical moonlit night because nobody's told about you.
That's Reckless Eric's Whole Wide World, recorded in 1977. He's married to my guest, Amy Rigby. You have a musical relationship as well as a marital relationship, and you've collaborated on albums together. How did you meet? Did you meet through music?
Yes, we did. I remembered hearing Eric back in the 70s, back in the dorm room, and loved Whole Wide World, Semaphore Signals. But it was in the late 90s. There were some reissues of his records, and I started listening to him again, and I started playing Whole Wide World in my own set. And it's just such an anthem. It's such a mystical, magical song. I found that any time I was maybe kind of struggling alone playing in a club that maybe wasn't some, there were some people that weren't so attentive in there, I'd just pull out that song, and it would focus, maybe it would focus me, but it would, someone who hadn't been paying attention would just snap to and start listening. And eventually that led to me meeting Eric in this town in England called Hull. A promoter there knew that I covered Eric's song, and he put Eric on as a DJ for my gig in this room up above a pub. I met him that night, and I played Whole Wide World. I asked him to come up on stage with me and play it with me, and he said, this song has two chords, and both of yours are wrong. And it turned out that that room was the first place he'd ever played the song. So, you know, I have to stop you.
Were you offended when he said, and both chords are wrong? Did he mean that in a funny way, or was he insulting you?
Well, he said it in a funny way, as he is a very funny person and has a way of saying these things that you just have to laugh. And it was charming. It was very charming. And so we kind of kept in touch sort of a little bit over the next couple years. I would hear that he was going to come see me when I'd be playing somewhere in England, and he never showed up. But it took a while, but eventually we got together.
Your relationship has completed a couple of circles. You know, you used to perform his song, Whole Wide World, and then you performed it with him, and now you're married. And then also, when you were young, you loved Elton John. And you actually, to give yourself a sense of identity when you were going to Catholic school, living in Pittsburgh, you thought of yourself as Elton Girl. And you used to, like, draw things related to Elton John and had all of his records. And Elton John, in his recent memoir, in his best-selling memoir, mentions your husband in it and says that in the early days when Elton John was just starting to perform, he had a crush on Eric.
Isn't it incredible?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised that he had a crush on Eric back then, but it was incredible to be on tour a couple of months ago when Elton John's book came out, and I was listening to it, the audio book, as I was driving along, and I'm driving down I-95, and I hear the actor who's doing the reading say, you know, I offered my services as a keyboard player to Stiff Records expressly because I had a crush on Reckless Eric. And, you know, I had to pull over to a rest area and just kind of sit with that for a minute. But, I mean, Eric had told me this amazing story of Elton coming on stage with him and coming along to a gig and playing with him back in the 70s. And it had meant a huge amount to Eric. And it just was a wonderful story. And so with Elton's book and that mention, that meant a lot because he thought, wow, he Elton remembered this. And so Eric wrote this beautiful blog about it. And, well, Elton read it. And so, you know, a few days after I heard the story in the book, Eric called and said, "I'm waiting for a call from Elton John." And they talked on the phone. And I just think it has all come full circle. It's wonderful.
I want to end with a song that you collaborated on with your husband, Eric Goulden. And it's called "Do You Remember That?" And this is from a 2012 album you did together called "A Working Museum." So what's each of your roles on this? Obviously, you're singing on it.
I wrote the song, words and music, and the beat. I found this rhythm on a crappy keyboard, and it was called the British rock beat, and that is the sound you hear on the recording. And I thought, well, you know, Eric is a British rock legend. That kind of inspired the song, was that kind of pumping rock beat, and I just wanted to tell our story in song. And then eventually, Eric has produced and engineered the records we made together and my solo album from 2018. And so, yeah, so we played it and he produced it and we're both singing on there.
And it's about your relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the song is "Do You Remember That?" from the Amy Rigby Reckless Eric 2012 album, A Working Museum. And Amy Rigby's new memoir is called "Girl to City." Amy Rigby, thank you so much. It's just been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Terry.
It was a cold December night. I was sorting out my life. You were headed for a mess, but you didn't know it yet. As I pushed in through the crowd, you were turning your
That's Amy Rigby from her album with Reckless Eric called Working Museum. Her new memoir is called Girl to City. After we take a short break, Justin Chang will review the new film drama inspired by the allegations against Harvey Weinstein. It's called The Assistant, and it's about a young woman working for a movie mogul. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. The independent film The Assistant was inspired by the allegations of sexual assault against Harvey Weinstein that emerged in the fall of 2017. Written and directed by the Australian filmmaker Kitty Green, it stars Julia Garner as a young college graduate growing increasingly uncomfortable in her job working for a New York-based movie mogul. The movie opens in theaters this week after having just screened at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Film critic Justin Chang has this review.
I emerged from an early screening of The Assistant a few weeks ago to the news that a jury had been selected in Harvey Weinstein's rape trial. Coming more than 2 years after The New York Times and The New Yorker first published their reports of sexual harassment and assault against the famed film producer, the headlines were a stark reminder of how long it can take for a wealthy and well-connected man to face the accusations against him in court, even after a stunning public downfall that helped give rise to the Me Too movement. Although it's not clear exactly when it's taking place, Kitty Green's quietly devastating movie returns us to a time before Me Too, and its explosive revelations of sexual abuse rattled the world, the entertainment industry in particular. The story unfolds over a single day in a New York film production office, run by a powerful mogul who is clearly modeled on Weinstein. But the character is never identified or seen. He looms menacingly large off-screen, invisible yet ever-present. Sometimes we hear his voice, booming yet muffled behind his office door. Sometimes we hear him barking on the phone at his overworked junior assistant, Jane, a college graduate who was hired just a few months ago. The actress Julia Garner, who won an Emmy for Ozark, plays Jane with piercing reserve. Whatever excitement she may have once felt at the chance to work for one of the film industry's most powerful figures seems to have abandoned her. Her workday begins early. It's still dark when she arrives at the office and starts making coffee and printing out box office reports. In the first sign that something might be amiss, we see her scrubbing a stain off the couch in her boss's office, then picking up a woman's earring off the floor. Her day gets busier from there. Her coworkers arrive, most of them youngish white men, who regard her with indifference at best and contempt at worst. The boss's wife calls several times, sounding irate and demanding to know where her husband is. He's catching a red-eye to Los Angeles that night, which means that Jane, the first to arrive at work, will also be the last to leave. You get the sense that no one wants to acknowledge the elephant in the room, but it clearly has something to do with the young women who drop by the office. One of them comes by to claim the lost earring. Another is being eyed as a candidate for an assistant job. As Jane learns, she's newly arrived from Idaho and is being put up by the boss at a fancy hotel in Manhattan. None of this comes as a shock to Jane. Everything we see happening seems to have happened before. But something about the young woman from Idaho, who couldn't seem more vulnerable or out of her element, causes something to snap inside Jane. Later in the day, she meets with someone in Human Resources. That's Matthew McFadyen, who plays Tom on HBO's Succession. He seems attentive and sympathetic at first, but Jane has trouble articulating her suspicions, and eventually he changes the subject.
What's your plan?
Sorry?
Where do you want to be in 5 to 10 years?
I want to produce. I want to be a producer.
You do?
Yeah.
That's excellent. We could use more women producers. You know, it's a tough job, but I can see that you've got what it takes.
Thanks.
So why are you in here trying to throw it all away over this bull?
Jane's conversation with HR is not just fruitless, but demoralizing. And in Garner's long pauses and terse replies, you can hear the seething frustration of a woman being condescended to and ignored. The Assistant is Kitty Green's first narrative feature, but it feels of a piece with her earlier documentaries, Ukraine is Not a Brothel and Casting JonBenet, both of which address the exploitation of women. Her nonfiction experience may account for the cool, observational intelligence of her filmmaking here. The Assistant is one of the most soul-deadeningly realistic movies about office life I've seen recently, and I mean that in a good way. It's so vivid in its portrait of entry-level monotony that it could fill you with dread even if you didn't suspect what was really going on. Some might find the storytelling too oblique or frustrating in its deliberately limited perspective. But it's the rigorous understatement of The Assistant that makes it so powerful in its vision of how easily the Harvey Weinsteins of the world could exploit their absolute authority for years with little fear of consequence. Moment by moment, it pulls us into a world where predatory behavior is concealed behind closed doors, and the silence of a hushed workplace becomes its own kind of complicity.
Justin Chang is a film critic for the LA Times. Tomorrow on Fresh Air, my guest will be Richard Hazen, an expert in election law and the author of the new book Election Meltdown: Dirty Tricks, Distrust, and the Threat to American Democracy. Hazen warns that the integrity of our elections is under threat by voter suppression, inept election officials, foreign and domestic manipulation through social media and fraud, and inflamed rhetoric. He also has some ideas about what to do about it. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Thea Challoner, Mood Zaidi, and Seth Kelly. My thanks to Dave Davies for hosting while I was on vacation. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the US, Europe, and Asia, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, whose Sickle Cell Disease Advancing Cures program supports cutting-edge research to cure sickle cell disease. Learn more at ddcf.org.